Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Bank of America is out $2.2 billion. That's their loss last quarter. CEO Ken Lewis is out $1.5 million. The White House pay czar isn't going to let him draw a salary this year. Taxpayers out $45 billion on B of A and still counting. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com. And by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. ProduceMoreConserveMore.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us on this Friday, everybody. It is the 16th of October today. Ken Lewis already has one foot out the door. He announced a couple of weeks ago that he'll be retiring at the end of the year. So the B of A news of this Friday isn't really about him and working for free this year. It's about how bad things look for Bank of America and, by extension, for taxpayers. But Marketplace's Elise Roth reports that things could be a lot worse.
B of A is the biggest retail bank in the country, and its worst problems all come from the parts of the bank that deal with regular Americans. Mortgages, consumer loans, and credit cards are all losing money. On the company's conference call this morning, Ken Lewis, the CEO, said he thinks the bank will keep losing money on those things into next year. Matt McCormick is a banking analyst at Ball & Gaynor, and he says the bank's problems could last even longer than that if the problems in the wider economy keep getting worse.
If you see another shoe to drop, it will likely happen in commercial real estate and then credit cards. And certainly Bank of America has exposure to both aspects of that deteriorating aspect of the economy.
Some people think today's news could have been a lot worse, though. Nancy Bush is an independent banking analyst, and she says she wasn't expecting much from the bank this quarter, and it ended up doing better than she thought it would.
I think the issue for Bank of America is, A, getting out from under TARP, B, getting their credit quality headed in the right direction in all segments, and really taking advantage of their position as the nation's number one depository institution.
Bush says it'll be a while before B of A can pay back all the money it borrowed from the government. And she says it could be years before it turns a profit. Meanwhile, Wall Street can't decide if it's time to buy B of A stock or to sell it. McCormick, the analyst, says get out now. But his peers at Morgan Stanley and Citigroup say B of A is on the up. And now's a great time to pick up a bargain. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Traders took the get-out option on B of A today. Shares were off about 5%. The dollar, meanwhile, picked up a little bit of ground from its recent run of bad luck. Over the longer term, though, the greenback is still down as low as it's been in more than a year. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner was out talking up the importance of a strong dollar today. Yesterday, it was White House Advisor Larry Summers' turn to do pretty much the same thing. But people who deal in the actual currency markets say it's pretty obvious the White House is saying one thing but doing another. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Just how sincere are these repeated assertions of support for a strong dollar? Senior currency strategist Richard Fernulovich chose his words carefully today when I reached him at Westpac Banking Corp.
I would say that for some time now, that's regarded as being empty rhetoric. There's not much backing it.
At Merck Investments, Chief Investment Officer Axel Merck's reaction was more blunt.
It's a farce these days. Everybody's laughing about it when he says that.
Merck says the administration is showing no real interest in propping up the dollar.
You have to back it up with policies that foster savings and investment. You do not back it up by printing trillions of dollars, by having enormous fiscal deficits.
Why would the government be quietly allowing the dollar to weaken? For one thing, it may be the simplest route to recovery if it makes our goods cheaper to sell abroad. David Huther is chief economist for the National Association of Manufacturers.
A more competitive dollar where dollar is not overvalued in combination with a recovering global economy allows U.S. manufacturers to take advantage of markets overseas and export our products. And it's important for manufacturers because about a quarter of what is made in the United States is exported overseas.
Investment advisor Axel Merck wonders if the government might be intentionally trying to use a little inflation to artificially boost home prices and jolt the economy.
It punishes anybody who is saving and encourages anybody who is speculating and who is highly in debt. If that's what you want as a policymaker, by all means pursue it, but then be frank about it.
But others say officials aren't about to shout that from the rooftops because doing so could risk causing the dollar to crash. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
I could give you the whys and wherefores of the stock market right about now, or I could just offer another way to think about the Dow hitting 10,000 this week. That gets us back to where we were in 1999. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The lasting question of the financial crisis goes something like this. Why? What happened to bring the big Wall Street banks to their knees? We could trot out the usual answers here about misplaced faith in the housing market and flat-out greed. Or we could talk to author and humorist Calvin Trillin. He wrote a column for the New York Times earlier this week offering another theory, his, that smart people finally started going to work on Wall Street. That's kind of funny because I'm pretty sure the assumption has been the smart guys were always working on Wall Street. Calvin Trillin, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Listen, if the smart people weren't always working on Wall Street, then you have to help us understand who was.
Well, it's fairly easy. The lower third of the class was working on Wall Street.
And the top of the class was doing what?
The top of the class were professors, judges, people who, by Wall Street standards, were making tip money, really.
So how did you have this idea to go researching this income and standing in the class thing?
I used my usual scientific controls, which is to say I made it up.
Perfect.
But I'm pretty sure that it's roughly correct. I mean, when you think about it, why wouldn't it be? The lower third of the class probably was there because of who they were rather than how they performed. So they didn't have any particular incentive to do well. They knew they would just go on to the firms their fathers had worked for.
So the lower third of the class sits in the back of, you know, Geology 101 and gets the gentleman's C's and then go to Wall Street because dad and granddad did?
Of course, there were many, many exceptions, but I think that was the general rule. And as I say in the piece, they were pleasant fellows. And also, by today's standards, they weren't really greedy. I mean, they wanted a nice house in Greenwich, a sailboat. No, they didn't need three ocean-going yachts or anything like that.
So what happened that the smart kids started going to Wall Street? How did that come to pass?
Two things happened. One is that the money on Wall Street became simply absurd. And at the same time, tuition went up so much that even people from relatively prosperous families were graduating from college with large debts. And so it was much more tempting. And that's when you started to see these stories about MIT geniuses who were, instead of going to physics graduate school, were going down to calculate arbitrage statistics in Wall Street.
I'm almost afraid to ask this, but is there any chance we could revert to the mean here and get the dumb guys back on Wall Street and the smart guys doing something else so that the financial system will get normal again?
Well, that would be good. But one of the problems, I think, in the last year or two was that the lower third of the class by that time were actually the heads of these firms. So the people who actually ran the firms didn't understand what was going on. They had no idea of how derivatives worked or anything like that. All they knew is that they were getting filthy rich. So I don't know what would have to happen to get everything back in order again.
Taking tongue out of cheek for a second, this right. column is all over Wall Street. It's all over the blogosphere. And obviously people like to read about their own professions. But are you surprised at the play that this thing's getting?
Yeah, I was surprised at the play. And I was also surprised that purely by accident, it seems to have struck some people as what happened. Somebody told me that a friend of hers who's a distinguished economist said, yeah, that it really explains it pretty well. I said, well, in that case, I think I'll tackle molecular biology next week.
Author, journalist, humorist Calvin Trillin, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
There was healthcare news this week, mergers and acquisitions too. That Dow 10,000 thing, if you're into meaningless numbers. But there were some fairly meaningful numbers this week too. Billions in profit for a couple of big Wall Street banks, billions in losses for a couple of others. So that is where we start our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond today. To do that, we've got Felix Salmon from Reuters with us, also business writer Heidi Moore. Good to talk to you both again.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
And it's great to talk to you, Kai.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that, because I posed to you today a very intractable, I think, question, Felix, and we might as well start with you. All this news about the banks this week, Citi and Goldman and J.P. Morgan and yada, yada, blah, blah, blah. What does it really tell us?
It tells us that the economy is actually in pretty bad shape. If you look at the credit write-downs at places like Citigroup and Bank of America, which are banking the real economy. And it shows us that everything east of the Hudson River is doing spectacularly well. If you look at the huge profits being made by the big investment banks like J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs. And so you have this weird cognitive disconnect between what's going on in the financial centers and what's going on in the rest of the country, where people are defaulting on their debt and they are having a really tough time in the biggest recession since 1930s.
So, Ms. Moore, weigh in on that last part, people defaulting on their debt. I mean, it's not going to get any better for the banks anytime soon, is it?
No, it's really not, actually. And I agree with Felix. We have a huge dissociative reality out there. And I mean, if you actually take a look at the average person on the ground in America, they can't afford the lifestyle that they're stuck in, and they can't pay it back, and they don't have jobs. And for Wall Street to be celebrating is just completely misleading.
Well, what does that tell us, Felix, about an economic recovery? I mean, Bernanke says the recession is technically over, and you are seeing some signs of life in housing and a little bit in consumers. I mean, what are we supposed to do with this information you're giving us here?
I think what we should do is take the people talking up the green shoots with a certain pinch of salt. The recession might well be over at this point, just in terms of GDP turning positive. But that doesn't mean that the economy is healthy. You know, it means that we have stopped falling into a black hole, and now we're in the black hole. It's not getting any worse, but that doesn't mean it's getting significantly better. It also means that the dollar is weakening again, you know, gold is strengthening again, that all of those kind of things help markets. They help assets which are denominated in dollars, like stock prices and that kind of thing. But they don't really help individuals.
Well, let me pick up on that then, Heidi. Is what Felix is saying that we're going to get some kind of double dip thing here, that it's going to get better and then the bottom's going to fall out again?
Well, I think that there's a certain faction of the U.S. population that we need to convince that everything is good. And that faction is CEOs. And once they start spending on their corporations and financing their corporations and hiring people for jobs, then we're good. And so if this head fake achieves that, then it's been a great head fake.
All right. Well, wait a second. I'm going to tell tales out of school here. You and I did a panel up in Boston earlier this week at which we had some very distinguished economists saying not that we have to convince CEOs, but we have to convince consumers that everything's OK, because they're the ones who are going to generate that demand that's going to get the CEOs hiring and ordering and all that stuff.
Well, the consumers cannot spend their way into jobs. In fact, saving and investing is probably what they should be doing right now. So it's true, consumers are important, but consumers are dependent on CEOs and other company leaders for their incomes.
Raise your hands, by the way, if you are completely sick and tired of talking about banks and bonuses and CEO pay and all that stuff.
My hand is down. I can never get enough talk of talking about banks and bonuses. It's incredibly juicy stuff. It's full of millions and tens of millions. And in the case of Ken Lewis, $125 million that he's going to be walking away with from Bank of America. And still you get quotes in the Wall Street Journal complaining that he's managed to lose $1.5 million on his annual salary.
These are like our Greek tragedies, right? These are our giant plays about human nature being played out on a massive scale. And we're actually kind of lucky to see this. We have gotten such insights into the characters and the actions of people who run companies. And I have to believe that that knowledge is not just useful, but as Felix said, extremely juicy.
Because really, that's what it's all about.
It really is.
We're going to learn stuff, but it's going to be juicy.
Yeah.
Felix Salmon from Reuters. Heidi Moore, she writes for The Big Money. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Cheers, Guy.
Coming up, money doesn't necessarily make for a rich life.
I like to say that a man should put himself in heaven at once. Don't wait till you die to go to heaven. Live heaven on earth. Understand the beauty of what's around you.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials fell 67 points today, two-thirds of 1%, closed at 9,995. The NASDAQ lost 16 points, three-quarters percent, ended the day at 2156. The S&P 500 gave back 9 points, eight-tenths percent, finished at 1,087. For the week that was, the Dow climbed 1 3/10 percent. The NASDAQ powered up 8 tenths percent. The S&P 500 rose 1.5%. Forget Bank of America. There was some good earnings news out there. Google sought out a 3 3/4 percent gain. The toymaker Mattel raced up 4.5% today. Bond prices gained. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.41%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. Miss anything in business news this week? Download our new podcast, After the Bell. Every Friday, Scott Jagow makes sense of the week in business and the economy. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The American Academy of Pediatrics continues its national conference in Washington. Sessions address everything from organic foods to online social networking. The National Association of Home Builders releases its monthly report on builder confidence in the single-family housing market. And South Park co-creator Trey Parker celebrates a birthday. He'll be 40. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. You think you've got problems with your finances? You have nothing at all on the Federal Reserve. As Mr. Bernanke and his colleagues said about rescuing the American banking system, they bought trillions of dollars worth of assets and debt from struggling banks, using taxpayer money, of course. But they never told anybody exactly where all that money went. That, as you might imagine, doesn't sit too well with the Congress. So next week, the House Financial Services Committee is going to vote on whether to force the Fed to open up its books. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has that story.
Republican Ron Paul of Texas has tilted against the Fed windmill for 11 terms in Congress. His past efforts to subject the central bank to audits never got more than 18 co-sponsors. This time, there are 295, including many Democrats. Paul, a two-time candidate for president, says the difference now is the financial crisis.
Really what got the attention of the American people was how poorly the Congress took care of the bailout funds, appropriating $700 billion, then finding out that nobody knew where it went, and a lot of people that didn't deserve to be bailed out got bailed out.
Paul's idea is to give Congress's watchdog, the General Accountability Office, the right to inspect the Fed's books and its conduct of monetary policy. Traditionally, the central bank has jealously guarded its autonomy. But to Paul, the bank is too secret.
They don't want to tell us what kind of agreements they've entered into with other banks, central banks around the world, other governments, and other financial institutions. This is pretty important. They're a government unto themselves.
It's likely Paul's proposal will be added to the large financial regulatory reform package that is the next big item on the congressional agenda after health care. Columbia Business School professor Charles Calamiris says the Fed's full-scale intervention in the banking system over the past year does call for more accountability at the Fed. But it shouldn't be imposed by Congress, which he blames for not dealing with the financial crisis just before last year's elections.
So the irony here, I would say a profound irony, and maybe you might even say hypocrisy on the part of the Congress, is that Congress's failure to act and unwillingness to act is the reason why things that should have been handled through direct fiscal actions by Congress had to be handled instead through the twisting of the Federal Reserve Act in various directions, which is exactly what's opened the door to all this need for transparency.
Calamiris says the Fed itself should be more forthcoming about how it spent bailout money. But the central bank refused to grant a Freedom of Information Act request from news organizations led by Bloomberg News for a public accounting of which banks got what help. The Fed argued that if the public knew what banks needed a bailout, customers' confidence in them would be undermined. But Bloomberg's editor-in-chief, Matthew Winkler, says when the news came out that Citibank received federal aid, its stock price shot up 50%.
So it's hard to argue that the government helping an institution stay afloat is going to cause a run or stigmatize it.
In August, the U.S. District Court agreed with Bloomberg and ordered the Fed to release its lending records. The Fed will appeal. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
It's easy to forget sometimes that there is more to life than just pulling down a paycheck, more than just trying to get ahead. Today, in our occasional series, Taking Stock, where we talk to people who can give us the longer view of our current economic circumstances, an interview with Robert Diggs. He is better known probably by his stage name, The RZA, and for a hip-hop group that he founded called the Wu-Tang Clan.
Cash rules everything around me. Cream, get the money. Dollar, dollar bill, yo. I grew up on the crime side.
In the 15 or so years since Wu-Tang started, The RZA has become an entrepreneur, a platinum-selling solo artist, and in his books, something of a philosopher, too. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Kyle.
This is your second book. You had the Wu-Tang Manual in 2005, and now you have this one, The Tao of Wu. What do you want to say this time that you didn't get to say last time?
Well, this first book was more dealing with a lot of Wu-Tang history itself and a lot of things relating to the music of the group. And this is more of a personal expression of my life experiences and the wisdom that's gained from it. It's not an autobiography, I want to get that clear, but it's definitely a lot of stories and things in my life, and hopefully it'll help some young people have a better day and a better chance at attacking the society.
Let's do the autobiography thing. I mean, what was life like for you as a kid and as you were starting the Wu-Tang Clan?
Well, as a child, you know, being one of 11 children, it was, you know, very hard times growing up in New York City. Seemed kind of hopeless, but always had faith in my heart and always had a lust for knowledge. And this lust for knowledge led me to learn hip-hop music and learn to express myself. And as I grew into a man, I became like more of a mentor to other brothers, even though I wasn't so much older than them, but they looked up to me for certain things. They took my wisdom and listened to it, and I was able to bring together a group of men, put together a band called Wu-Tang Clan, sell millions of records, start clothing lines, and all kind of different Wu products.
Do you ever have any ego problems with these guys?
Well, ego always exists, you know? Ego exists, and we are men, you know? Men, you know, with all that testosterone inside of us, you know, we definitely have friendly competition, sometimes not so friendly. And egos jump out, you know, 1 minute, because at any given moment, any one of us could be the star of the group. Nowadays, Raekwon, the chef, is considered one of the hottest members of Wu-Tang Clan right now with his new album, Cuban Links Part 2, and he lets you know that he's the man right now.
So here you are, 15 years after you started the Wu-Tang Clan. You are successful and rich, and you're doing well, and you've got a great organization behind you. And yet, just to back up to something you said a moment ago, you've written this book, the new book, The Tao of Wu, as a way to get kids figuring out a good way to attack this society. What does that mean?
I don't like to say that I'm rich. I like to say I'm rich in heart, you know?
Fair enough.
I've never really been a money-hungry guy or chasing money, and I probably gave a lot of my money away to the people who needed it more than me, I guess. But what I mean is that, you know, we go through our society, you know, we grow up, you know, a lot of us is underprivileged, and especially in today's, you know, recession, there's a lot of hard times out there for people. And if you think that money is the only cure to your solution, you know, you'll never find a cure. Wisdom is a cure. You know, it's all through perception. I like to say that a man should put himself in heaven at once. Don't wait till you die to go to heaven. Live heaven on earth. You could be in a small apartment inside a project. If you have the right mentality, that project could be a paradise for you. But it's the mentality that we carry with ourselves every day that makes our surroundings uglier than what they really are. You know, for instance, I grew up in a project called Stapleton Projects in Staten Island, right?
Mm.
And it's a very tough place to grow up. You know, you got guns, drug dealers, murderers, and guys were, you know, with urinate in a staircase and all these kind of things, right? But then I go to California, and there's a place called the Oakwood Apartments. Very similar structures, you know what I mean? But it's nice, and everybody's happy, and people was working, and the grass is clean and there's no urination in the stairway. It's really the mindset of the people that makes the place good or bad.
So what have you learned in the past year? You know, I mean, as you look at this economy and as you look at people suffering and as you look at people trying to hang on to that wealth that that they have or had, I guess, you know, what has that done to your art? I mean, how has that affected what you do?
Well, really, I learned balance is important. I was questioned last year before Mr. Obama took the presidency. People was like, well, he's going to raise the taxes, and that means that you're going to have higher taxes because you are above that $250,000 year quota, right? Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, you know what? If I have to pay a little more extra so others could have a little more food, clothing, and shelter, then let me pay. Because, you know, what you want for yourself, you should want for your brother and for your fellow man. Now, everybody, we don't all don't need things that we yearn for. And I try to teach my children that nowadays more than ever, like, yo, okay, there's some things you want and some things you need. Let's do what we need and not what we want more. And that alone will help you get through a recession because your eyes want it all. You know, the cake looks good, the coat looks good, the car looks nice, but do you need it? And yeah, I'm willing to accept that.
But, you know, a lot of hip-hop is about that. It's about the bigger house and the better car and the jewelry and all that stuff. I mean, how do you reconcile, you know, your personal attitude with some of what your art and those who do your art have said?
You know, talking to kids who grew up with nothing. So we all dream of a mansion and dream of big cars because we don't have it and we see it, others having it. But I think that's actually, it's not a good thing to really promote and glorify those things. Because P. Diddy said in one of his old songs, more money, more problems, yo. You know what I mean? And, you know, sometimes a simpler life is better for you.
The RZA is the founder and the leader of the hip-hop group called Wu-Tang Clan. He writes books, too. The latest one is called The Tao of Wu. Listen, thanks a lot.
Thank you a lot.
To read a chapter of The Tao of Wu, you can check our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on a Friday afternoon, which comes with the observation that an ounce of gold traded at $1,070 today. So should you be interested in really diversifying your portfolio, the British department store Harrods has just the thing for you. Gold by the bar, the kind you see in old bank heist movies, 27.5 pounds apiece for just shy of $500,000 each. That story brought to you by the Marketplace Desk of Marketing Ideas for people with more money than sense. Marketplace, the radio program, is brought to you by American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 67 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ down 16 points, 0.75%. The S&P 500 fell 9 points, 0.8%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Weston. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, even big television stars make big money mistakes.
I wound up buying a house that I spent all my money on the down payment alone. So I bought a house that I really couldn't afford.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will be back here on Monday. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.